This podcast with Isabel Fernandez-Mateo is a London Business School lecture on building your career strategy. Isabel Fernandez-Mateo is a DECO Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship at London Business School, and much of her research focuses on how social networks influence career outcomes, particularly in hiring, job transitions, and career advancement.
I'm happy to be here with you at the end of the day. And I've been doing research on these themes of careers and career strategy for quite a long time. But I am a professor of strategy, which means that I look at these issues from the perspective of strategic management. I use the tools of strategic management to understand our own strategy, how it is that we think about our own careers and how to manage them, as if they were a company almost. And what I will be doing today is I'm going to give you a little bit of a taster of this course, which I have, which is called Building Your Career Strategy, the main aspects of it, what it is that we talk about, and hopefully give you some practical tools that you can use for yourselves as well. So let me just tell you something that some of you may or may not know, but when we think about why people go to business school, either for executive education or more generally for MBAs or for executive MBAs, one of the most cited reasons, not the only one, but one of the most cited reasons is to advance their careers, or to progress their careers in one way or another. So when we think about career success or career advancement and the reasons why people come to business school related to that, we tend to think of this progression, I like it, climbing up, like this metaphor of the ladder. We call it the career ladder. The idea that, you work hard enough, you put yourself there, and you just have to keep doing the things that you're supposed to do, and eventually you will climb up and get to some sort of top, right? But we know that, that's not the case anymore, right? In a way, careers are, if you wish, broken. Career ladders are broken. And that 3 years number there is the average time that executives now spend on one job. It's not very long, right? 3 years, not very long. That's from some data from Harvard Business Review, but I've done my own research on this, which, by the way, that's another thing that we do here at the business school. We do research, and that research, we use it directly to inform our teaching. And I did a survey recently, a few months ago, of our MBA and executive MBA alumni. So I have data from around 3,000 of them, with all the data on their careers, how they have moved, a million things, a lot of good detail. And also I find similar numbers. I find that people stay in the same job for around 3 years. It varies depending on industry, depending on how long they graduated ago, but it's not very long in one particular job. There is a tricky thing though when we think about careers as young adults. I think they are more relevant for today's world of work, but at the same time, they require us, you, to take charge, right? Because the path is not clearly laid out and there are many different combinations, so you actually need to put much more thought about which of those paths are you gonna take. That's when the idea of your own career strategy and thinking of your career as a company comes in, because now you have to actually take a proactive role. You need to plan in a way and think about how you're gonna do that, because it's no longer a ladder, right? When we think about career success and doing it in a proactive way, I think one discussion that I like to have, and I think that is sometimes helpful, is to think about, but what does make somebody successful in their career? I would like us to think about that, right? So let's think for a few minutes, because I would like to do this a little bit interactive, and let's think a little bit about what makes people successful. So, basically performance, or yes, they do their job very, very well, right? Well, the lights don't seem to be working. So you see, when we look at this, most of the things that you said that make somebody successful in their career, which are on this side of the graph, are things that have to do with the individual, right? Our individual characteristics, our personal characteristics, or personality, motivations, skills, behavior, so on and so forth, right? Then you talk a little bit also about some things that have to do with the context, with relationships mostly. You talk about relationships because mentorship relationships, the networks that you have. You could also have said other things about the context around the person, which would be, what kind of organization you are in. what kind of culture, which country, a million other things about the context, but you did emphasize relationships. And then, of course, we have luck, right? So these are, in a nutshell, the three main elements. So all these things are related to each other, and they all actually contribute to career success, right? And when we think about navigating this jungle gym, we have to start thinking about those. But we're going to ignore luck for a moment, just because, again, we don't have time to really delve into that. And we're going to focus on the other two. And one thing that I would like you to remember from what we are talking about today is that when we think about career success, one of the helpful ways of thinking about this navigation of the jungle gym is to think about how we can position ourselves in ways that our individual characteristics match the social context, right? So if you think about the context like the type of jobs, the type of companies, the type of opportunities, you are going to have to be making those decisions over and over again as you navigate this. Imagine each of these is a position, and at each point in time, you are going to have to be asking yourself, does this point match my individual strengths and abilities and weaknesses or not? So I have to be very, very conscious every time I move of whether that's going to be fitting or not. So this match idea is a very, very important idea when navigating jungle gym. One that was also important in the career ladder, but in a way, not as much because the path was clear. But here the path is not so clear, right? To explain to my students in this course is that it's almost completely useless to plan, to have a complete career plan in which you are going to have everything laid out for the next 25 years. Because it's very difficult in this context to do so. But one thing we can do is, we may not have a map, but we can have a compass, right? So in a way, it's substituting, replacing the idea of the map for the idea of the compass. And that compass has to be related to this match. Like at each point in time, whether each new opportunity matches or not your individual strengths and your individual abilities. So that is a compass that can guide you as you go along through this jungle gym. Should they stay with the same company or should they move to another company? Should they try to make an internal move, a promotion, or should they go somewhere else? Has any of you ever experienced that dilemma? Suppose many of you, right? Some of you at least have thought, should I quit this job and go somewhere else or not? And what we know is that those moves are not made equal. There are actually trade-offs. So for example, we know there is evidence from MBA alumni, from some of my collaborators' research, but also some of my research as well, that internal moves are the easiest way to move into a job with more responsibilities. Okay, so it's much easier to get promoted internally than externally. And that is a fact. That is something that we've learned. However, it's also the case that on average, when you get a promotion within a company, on average, not always, but the trend is that usually it will be with the same kind of work. So it will be harder for you to change functions or roles, or in most organizations, it will be a promotion within the same kind of work. And it will be constrained by the opportunities available. So I don't know if you heard about this quote by Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook. When she took a job at Google, she said, when you are offered a seat in a rocket ship, you don't ask which seat, you just go and sit. You just take it. So, you know, the growth of the organization determines a lot your prospects, right, obviously. When you think about external moves, they're slightly different. We have a lot of evidence that suggests that it can take 2 or 3 years for people to get up to speed when they move to a different company, and I can tell you more about that if you're interested. And usually, it's much, much harder to get a promotion, like a significant promotion in terms, for example, of increasing number of reports or something like that, when you move to another organization. So generally, you might get an increase in pay, so they would pay you more, but it would be less likely that you get promoted. And also, the increase in pay, you will get it if you stay in the same function, but people often use external moves to move to a different function. So if you want to do a different type of job, you might have to move organizations. So there are real trade-offs implied in what kind of moves you do. And when I talk with my students, we spend a lot of time trying to understand those trade-offs. And for example, I get very nervous if somebody tells me, oh, I'm just gonna take this job in this other organization, and you know, I might not get a promotion now, but then they will promote me later. that's tricky, right? If what you want is to increase your level of responsibility, you might be better off staying in the organization, get promoted, and being able to make the jump to another organization at a higher rank of the ladder. That's going to happen more often than it actually if you try to get the promotion from outside, right? But anyway, I'm just giving you an example of how these different moves matter and why it's important to keep in mind these different types of transitions when you think about your career, right? What do I mean? All these elements of moves and transitions fit into what I call a career strategy. And what is a career strategy? Career strategy is a very, very simple idea. So the way I think about a career strategy is just a very simple definition. It's the combination of individual and contextual choices that allow you to create value, succeed, and adapt over time. Individual choices have to do with your strengths, with your abilities, with your motivation, with your personality. If you were a firm, this would be your value proposition. This would be your brand. This could be your positioning in the market, right? We know that a strategy, a firm strategy, is composed by the positioning, the value creation, the business model, and also the resources that you have to fulfill that strategy. So that would be the individual. The contextual has to do with what are those dots, right? Are the internal moves, the external moves, what type of companies, what type of people you are hanging out with, what are your networks, and so on and so forth, right? And these are choices. That means they require trade-offs, the same as in the strategy. If you are not making trade-offs, if as a company you are not giving something up, those are not strategic choices. So very often they require very significant trade-offs. And the other element of this current strategy is that it has to be something flexible, that you are able to adapt over time. So that's where the idea of the compass comes in again, right? It's the idea that I cannot tell you how to plan your career for the next 10 years, but I can tell you what to look for at each point in time regularly so you know whether you are on the right track or not, right? And that's the best way to navigate the jungle gym, like thinking about making those decisions and making them in an adaptable way. Okay. Another way of thinking about this question of what do you work for is this idea of what we call, what's your anchor? What's your career anchor? What is the thing about your career or that your job that you would not give up to make a difference? That's another one, another career anchor, the sense of purpose or service or changing something in the world. Yeah. So those are, in fact, people can be classified in terms of 8 different career anchors. So there is evidence on this, and so there are some people who work for things that have to do with technical competence. This is the idea of the engineer, you know, the functional person, right? Who sometimes the organizations want them to become managers, and they don't really want to become managers, right? They want to be functional experts because that's what they thrive on. There are people who would never give up on their managerial orientation. They really want to manage people. That's what they like to do. And there are a lot of people who are like that. They really want to manage people. Other people wouldn't give up on their autonomy or their activity or their dedication to a cause or service or meaning. Some people are motivated by pure challenge, just by keeping doing things differently all the time. And others by their life, the lifestyle, the work-life balance, right? So this is the idea that we call a career anchors. In fact, you can go there and you can take the test and figure out which one is yours. So there are ways of figuring it out. And I think it's important to know, in a way, the answer to this question. And again, in my course, we spend a lot of time on this because very often when people have a sense of dissatisfaction with their career, they're not sure where they're going, they're not sure that is this all there is because the path they have chosen doesn't match their career anchor, or it doesn't match it completely, right? Maybe they put themselves in the managerial career track, but they really, really would rather dedicate themselves to some other. So that's an important question, but the evidence suggests that most of us have a core anchor. We can have 2, maybe, right? So, you know, when I took the test myself, I had autonomy and poor challenge were my anchors, right? And you can have 2. You don't have to have only 1. But this is the thing that you would never give up on. And when people think they have changed, it might be because they have never actually been forced to make a real choice. Or they've always had that career anchor, but they actually, never been in the situation in which their career angle matched the context, right? So they might have the sense that it has changed over time because they changed the context, but the anchor was always there. So they don't change very much. That's a long-winded question to know. They don't change very much. But it's very important to respect our anchor, right? To figure out what our anchor is and to respect it, because the idea is that when we think about the definition of career success, in a way, success is what you make of it, but it really, deep down, is to find yourself in a situation in which your context matches your anchor, right? That you are actually getting out of work what you really want to get out of work, and whatever that is. And in the traditional context of the career ladder, other people might actually have defined it for you. But here, you have to define it yourself. And it's more stressful, but actually it's also more fulfilling, because you can pick it, right? You can actually pick that match better, as opposed to, I've been here for 5 years now, the next step is I have to be a vice president, and the next step is I have to be this, or I have to be that. Well, maybe yes, maybe no, right? But you do have to respect your anchor. So the individual part is that, and again, in my time on that, and then there is the contextual part, okay? And we're going to spend a few minutes discussing that one as well. There are many aspects of the context, but the one that actually you also pointed out is important is the relationships around it, right? I have my picture that symbolizes relationships. That's a network, the social network, relationships, right? So one of the things I do in my research, I study how social networks help people's careers. So how relationships, how they manage the relationships, how that helps their career progress, their career success, their creativity, innovation, and so on and so forth. And I spend a lot of time discussing that. And of course, when we think about how social networks affect careers, many often you hear this statement that, well, it's not just what you know, but it's who you know, right? When people think about social networks affecting their careers, they think about relationships, they think about networking, they think about who are the people that they know, right? And that's a very, very extended way of looking at the relationship between networks and career success. If you go to Amazon and type networking or social networks, you find lots of books. They look like that, right? You know, Masters of Networking, Highly Effective Networking, The Power of Networking, and they all follow the same model, which is, this is a person who knows a lot of people, and they go and tell you how to go meet a lot of people, basically, right? Or, in these days, LinkedIn connections. I accumulate as many LinkedIn connections as possible. The implicit idea being that social networks help your careers, the more you have, the better. So the more relationships you have, the better. The more LinkedIn connections, the more people you know, just accumulate the social relationships, right? And of course, intuitively, many of us suspect that that's probably a simplistic way of thinking about how networks shape your career. But it's not only simplistic, I would dare to say that it might be even wrong, right? And counterproductive. So that might be not very helpful. So let me show you two types of social networks. Imagine that this is the social network. Imagine this is a person called, this is Julia and this is Bob. And they both know the same number of people, right? So if they went to Amazon and bought this book about growing their network, they both would know the same number of people. However, there is a difference. Bob, all the people he knows, they are all connected to each other, so they don't know each other. While in the case of Julia, they don't. So some of these people don't know each other. Who is more likely to come up with creative ideas? The evidence is very clear. It's going to be Julia, right? Because, you know, think about it. What is coming up with new ideas? What is innovation, right? Well, innovation is recombination. Innovation is coming up with bits and pieces of. There's nothing new under the sun, right? Everything has been invented. The new ideas come from putting things together. When everybody knows each other, the information is complete, but they're all talking about the same thing all the time, right? It's much, much more likely that not only that they are similar people, but even if they are not similar in their demographic backgrounds or whatever, they all are talking to each other, it becomes an echo chamber almost, right? So it's very difficult for new ideas to come in when these are very, very dense networks. It is much more likely it's going to happen here, which I think is a very interesting idea, I think, because when we think about how social networks create value, very often we think about the connections. How do connections create value? But here, what we are actually saying is that the value here is in the disconnections. There is value in the fact that people are not connected. that the people in your network are disconnected from each other. And that is going to have consequences for how you create value, not only in organizations, but in your career as well, to be honest, right? And there is a lot of evidence that that is the case. So there are 50 years of research evidence that suggests that managers who have social networks who look more like junior are more creative than their peers. There is evidence from music, like the most innovative music comes from the disconnections, from philosophy, from science, this is very well established in science, from entrepreneurship. So this is even at the firm level. Companies, for example, startups that have connections to disconnected partners are more likely to go IPO, to make more money, so on and so forth. And also from executive careers as well, which is more relevant to our discussion today. And in fact, don't worry about what it says there. But just to show you, there is a lot of evidence that suggests that people who look more like Julia or when we compare to their peers, they are more likely to have higher performance evaluations, more likely to be promoted, and so on and so forth. That doesn't mean that, you know, that doesn't mean that the people like Bob are not helpful for some other things, right? And it's all relative, it's compared to what? And the reason why the relative part matters is that most of us tend to become more like Bob over time. We tend to stay in our clusters because it's more comfortable, right? And that actually also constrains careers a lot, because we end up talking with the same people all the time, thinking about the same things. And by the way, let me just give a plug for Bob. Bob is good for something else. What would Bob's network be good for? Are good for coming up with new ideas, but then somebody has to actually implement those ideas. And it is much easier to implement ideas in a dense network in which everybody, there's a certain level of trust, there's a certain level of identification, and so on and so forth. Yes?
What happens when you put Julia and Bob together? How do you make them work with each other?
Yeah, so we do this very in my course, we spend 5 hours talking about that. Because of course, you get on the real problem, right? When I was talking about trade-offs, there's a huge trade-off here, right? Because on the one side, you want a network like Julia to be innovative. On the other side, you want a network like Bob's to be good at implementing. It's like organizations. Have you heard about the context of exploitation versus exploration? So many of you might have heard about it, right? So organizations need to be very good at implementing, so exploitation, like Bob, dense networks, but they also have to be very good at coming up with new ideas, so to keep constantly adapting, right? So in your career, it's exactly the same thing. You need to be very good at what you do and implement, and for that you need a dense network, but you need to be very good at changing and adapting, so you need a network like that. And the solution, we cannot spend a lot of time on that, but the solution has to do with something that we call the rainmaker network. So fashion yourself in a position in which you have a very dense network of close contacts, for example, within your department or your division or something like that, that will allow you to get things done, but at the same time, that you have a sparse network outside, across the organization, across different parts of the industry, and so on and so forth, that allows you to become more like Julia and get the ideas and then get them done inside. So it's a bit more complicated than that, but that's the general idea. The reason why I emphasize the Hedis network is because most people are much worse than that they are at being like Bob. Like most people are much better at the implementation part, but they are not as good as the others. So if you have to emphasize something, go for that one, but we do need both. But over the course of your career, you are going to need to be good at both, right? So you need to actually think about how to, in a way, when we think about firm strategy and we think about combining exploitation and exploration, for those of you who are familiar, some of you might have heard the concept of ambidexterity. Have you heard about that? The ambidextrous organization, which is the same idea. How do you actually combine both? You can do it over time, you can do it within firm or outside firm, but that's actually an important part of career management as well, and one that I spend a lot of time discussing. It's complicated, but it's actually treatable. You can think about this, right? So the sparse network is the disconnected one. The dense network is the closed one. Yeah, that's the name. Anything else? No? Okay, so let me just finish or sum up with what I like to call the 5 rules of career strategy. You could have 6 or you could have 4. I like 5. It's a nice number. So, which is sort of a summary of what we've been discussing. I'll be happy to take more questions. The first one is, again, you need to take charge. Why do you need something called building your career strategy or something of that sort? It's because nobody's going to do it for you. So if you are going to do it yourself, you need to figure out how to navigate this. And this is not easy.
time.
This is not easy. But it's actually, if you do know how to do it, or if you have some rules about how to do it, can give you a lot of opportunities. And thinking yourself as a company, as opposed to as a person, helps a lot for this. The second one is don't plan. Forget career planning, it doesn't really work. But monitor. Don't have a map, have a compass. And have those two building blocks, which are the individual and the context, and at each point in time, regularly, monitor whether they match and whether this is actually the point in that jungle gym in which you want to be at each point in time. The truth is that most of you are the village people, right? You are going to have lots of opportunities. The very fact that you are here today means that you are the village. And opportunities will come to you. And what makes or break the sense that we are progressing in our career is whether you pick the right opportunities or not. It's not the lack of opportunities, because the opportunities are going to be there all the time. It's which opportunities you choose. And you need some sort of method, which is this idea that I call the compass, in order to choose those opportunities. And you can actually do a lot of work ex ante with these type of tools to think about what are those elements, so when the next time an opportunity comes and I need to decide whether to move to the right or to the left or up or down, then I have something to guide me, right? And this is something which is flexible. It's not a plan written in stone. It's a flexible tool that I can take with me over the years, right? So don't plan, monitor. And when you monitor, think about respecting your career anchor. A key part of the individual element of this monitoring is what do you work for? That you have to figure out. I told you, there's a website you can go, take a test, but there's a lot of introspection exercises and a lot of things that you can do in order. Some of you know already, but for some of you, there's a little bit of discovery required in order to be true to your career anchor and to know exactly what it is that you work for, right? Then, in terms of the networks, embrace the disconnections. Think about how to build social relationships that will give you resources over time for your career. And one very important thing that we don't have a lot of time to discuss, but is absolutely essential, you need to build those relationships before you need them, right? So another problem that I very often encounter with my students, but this not so much with the executives, more with the early career students, is that they think that, okay, I need networks for finding a job. Okay, who do I have to contact now? That doesn't work, right? The moment that you go and try to create a contact because you know what you want to get out of that person for an instrumental reason, it's too late. Mm-hmm. It's just too late. You have to do these things way in advance. That's why this planning, this building your career strategy involves trying to have into account what are the kind of social network that I need for my purposes and start building it now in a meaningful and non-instrumental way. So building these relationships is a way of life. This requires also, what I do in my course is I give people assessments so they actually know whether they look more like this or like this, sparse networks versus dense networks with respect to their colleagues. So there are actually ways of figuring this out. We can, give you tools that will help you, and then they will help you assess which way do you want to move, and which gaps in your network you need to fix. And people get very surprised when they look at these things and they realize that what they thought the social network was, in fact, compared to it with their colleagues, is actually not, not what it really is. Right? So embrace the disconnections. And the last one, which I haven't talked more about, but what does every company need? A company needs a board of directors, right? You need a board of directors as well, right? So some of you mentioned mentorship. When we think about mentorship, very often we tend to think about one person. Like it would be one person that, is like an all-purpose mentor that will help us over our career. And this is not just for junior people. Senior people need mentors too, and they talk about mentors as well. I always joke about when I went to Davos a couple of years ago, there were all these sessions about how to find a mentor. And I was like, these people need mentors? Really? Actually, they apparently need mentors. So, but I don't like thinking about mentors as the mentor, the person. I actually think more about assembling your board of directors. Any company that respects itself and is well-governed has a bunch of advisors. It's a bunch of people who have different skills and different abilities and different motivations, and they are going to help you. And I help my students to figure out who their board of directors are and what kind of benefits these people are bringing. And some of those benefits may be very instrumental, like sponsorship, like vouching for promotions, things like that. But others might be more psychosocial, more like, you know, a shoulder to cry on. And it's very important not to mix them, because some people are good for one but not for the other. You know that. We all know the person who is going to help you get that job, but don't go cry to them because they're not going to be there for you. But you need those other people. So then you need to assemble these, right? And people who are from different industries, many of us tend to be advised all the time by the same people. You know what's one of the biggest problems that people have when they are making a career transition? Is that they are using social networks that are really mirrors, right? You look at them and they reflect the person that you already are. The people who know us very well, it's very hard for them to see us in a different capacity, because you know they've always seen us doing the same thing. So they're actually not very helpful when we want to do something different. So you need another set of people to hang out with, right? And so on and so forth. So anyway, board of directors is very important, okay? But very often people get very hung up on the fact that they think a mentor must be for life. Mm-hmm. And actually, successful mentorship relations or advisor relations, they last like for 5 years or something like that. They can evolve. And the person who was your sponsor may become your friend. So they do evolve. And it's important that they evolve. And again, we also have tools and questionnaires and assessments to help you think about that evolution. Any other question? Okay, and finally, I'd like to leave you with my 10-90 principle, which is my course is 1 week, right? And I spend 1 week like with all these tools and do this and do that. And at the end, you know, I told my students, this is extremely important. You should spend time thinking about this, but this is not what you should be doing most of your time, right? So 90% of your time, you should be just working. Actually doing your job as well as possible and performing, because that's the most important thing. You actually need to be very good at your job, 90%. So think about 90% of your time is that, 10% of your time you have some sort of strategy, you have some monitoring, you know, you have to do all these other things I told you. The trick is that 10% can make this 90% much more valuable, because most people don't actually do that, right? So if you spend this 10%, it actually is going to pay off, but it shouldn't take all your life. So I'll leave you with that. I'll put my email address there as well. And if you have any questions or anything else, feel free to contact me. And I hope that you have a nice, you have drinks now, right?
Yeah.
And the rest of your time here. And thank you for coming.
This lecture is from LBS Live at London Business School. Find out more about LBS's short courses at london.edu/executive education. And for more fresh ideas from LBS's experts, visit london.edu/LBSR.